is acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our God and our Redeemer. Amen. Good morning to you all this first day of Advent. This morning I wanted to look at the Old Testament reading we heard read so beautifully, because I think that as we approach Christmas Day, the day that we celebrate the Incarnation, it is appropriate, it is meet and right, that we look at the Old Testament. Because even today, there remains confusion about how these two testaments are related. Now, I don't want to downplay the difficulties, because this relationship is complicated. It's full of interpreted difficulties, of time, of authorship, of intent, of translation. And many people, when they look at the Old Testament, these problems just lead them to not touch it. Just sort of leave it alone, have it read, and then preach from the gospel. And I'm very sympathetic to this way of looking at it. But this tension has existed throughout the entire history of Christianity. In the beginnings, the first Christians, there was a tendency, it played into their Greek worldview and religious sort of framework, but that there were two gods. There was a God of the Old Testament and a God of the New Testament. And in fact, this was a heresy, one of the first heresies condemned by a guy named Marcion, who said that the Old Testament God was defeated by the New Testament God. And this later became something that was called Manichaeism, which one of the most famous converts from Manichaeism to Christianity was the great Saint Augustine, who gave us a lot of sort of ways to defend against Manichaeism. But at the root of this, at the root of both of these things, still lies this difficulty, because when you look at both, it's understandable to have a little bit of sort of what we would say cognitive dissonance about how to reconcile these two messages. Now, for some who, in light of the fact that the church has never let go of the Old Testament, there are ways that people have developed to understand it. Now, for some, the Old Testament remains its significance, keeps its significance in sort of an allegorical or typological way, meaning that the actual stories of the people, the historical King David, the Moses, Aaron, Abraham, these people, their actual lives are sort of flattened out, and they become sort of like Aesop's fables for people. The King David is a perfect example of this, that Goliath comes to represent any sort of great trial you have in your life, and can you be King David? Or the fact that King David had 5 stones in his bag that he picked up before he went and fought Goliath, and so the message becomes, what are the 5 stones that you have in your life to defeat the giants in your life? And this can be taken for anything. Nehemiah, for instance, who rebuilt the wall, can often be heard as, what sort of wall do you need to rebuild in your life? Be like Nehemiah. Be like Moses. Don't be like Jacob. Something like this. And so the Old Testament retains its significance in this way. Now, for other people, they take the Old Testament and pick and choose from parts of it, particularly from the law aspects of it, to create the God that they want. And this is where you see people, for instance, pointing to the book of Malachi, which has a lot of things on tithing. And I'm very sympathetic to this also, but at the same time, they'll preach from Malachi and say, God says tithe to Malachi. Malachi says you tithe. Therefore, we have this one-to-one ratio. They sometimes pass over the laws that say don't have tattoos, depending on where you're preaching, and particularly the one that says don't wear a fabric of 2 types of material. Now, one can sympathize, of course, with the practical and sort of aesthetic value of not wearing poly-cotton clothing. Nevertheless, it's still difficult to, when you approach the Old Testament this way, because you're left invariably chopping out pieces of it that don't fit your what you wanted to say. And it can happen on either side. It can either be the sort of culturally moral things that you find very abhorrent in today's world, or it could be the sort of socio-political message, because the Old Testament is full of both of these things. It's full of exhortations for personal holiness, and it's full of exhortations for communal holiness. So what are we going to do? What do we do? Well, I propose, and today, that the Old Testament, the relationship between the Old and New Testament, is only understood through the cross of Christ. Because when we look primarily at Jesus' life, right? When we look at his life, what he did, what he said, when we look primarily at this, then we'll be tempted to see the whole of the Bible, including the Old Testament, as one huge morality tale. Be like Jesus. Walk like Jesus. Do what Jesus said. Jesus becomes the effective coach that we never had, the really motivating guy who's just nice enough but just mean enough to make us really go out and do it. This is the sort of Jesus that can happen when you focus primarily on his life. Now, when you focus primarily on his resurrection, on the other hand, then you get this idea that it's ganz vorbei, that everything is over, nothing really matters except for this great unknown potential that is coming, that the here and now is not as important as what will be and what can be. And therefore, we live, forget the Old Testament, we barely live in the New Testament, because every aspect of life is focused on the future. And we leave the past and we leave the present in many instances. And we find ourselves using this concept of God simply as a projection of our temporal hopes and dreams. And so this, on one hand, we have this idea of Jesus as the sort of the moral exemplar. And on the other hand, we have this Jesus as fulfilling all the potential of my life. And in both of these constructions, although having grains of truth, they both miss the point. Because only when we look at the Old Testament and the New Testament through the lens of the cross can we appreciate what it actually is. Because it's not a guide for holy living any more than it's a power book for the victorious life now. Because what it is the story of a holy God's dealing with a lost and broken humanity. And it's not a story of our faithfulness to him, but it's a story of his faithfulness to us, his fulfillment of his promised redemption. And this is the promise that we heard read from Jeremiah, and the one that we look towards the fulfilling on Christmas Day in the incarnation. Because the gospel is not a lifestyle, although it creates one. It's not a proposition just to believe, although it is stated as such. And it cannot be sentimentalized into a generalized command to love or to endure or to persevere or something like this. Because the gospel is the specific message that the promised Messiah and deliverer and redeemer, the one prophesied from Genesis, when Adam and Eve were banished from the garden, God said, I will raise up a seed that will crush the head of the serpent. This was what we call the proto-gospel, the beginnings of the promise that God, in fact, had plans to redeem the world. And this runs from Genesis through Revelation, and it's centered on the cross. So this is how we understand the Old Testament, that the same God who ruled from on high, who sent his law down with lightning and thunder, the same God that commanded the Israelite army around and about, the same God in whose presence, in whose very presence people would fall down dead. This is the same God that we see hanging on a tree outside of Jerusalem, crying out, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. This is why the cross is the center of our faith, because it's only there that we see the depth of our problem both the depth of our problem and the extent to which God goes for us. Then we can begin to see the effects of sin on our lives and come to grips with this idea, as we say in the Book of Common Prayer, that we are miserable sinners. Now, this doesn't mean, as it often is understood, that we are terrible, rotten, awful people. But in the heart of Archbishop Cranmer, when he wrote this, it was that sin, brokenness, envy, jealousy, lust, strife, these sins create miserable people. People who know no joy. People who live in anxiety and fear and just constant turmoil. This is the misery that we cry out from when we say, deliver us. The one that Peter had a glimpse of when Jesus approaches him on the Sea of Galilee, and Peter says, go away from me, for I am sinful. This is a picture, just a glimpse, that we get when we look at the cross. But that's not the only glimpse we get, because it's also, to the extent, to even at the depths of that, we get to see the heights of God's love, his promise fulfilled, the statement that he has not left, that he has, in fact, fulfilled his promise made thousands of years ago that he will redeem the world. As we hear in John, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn it, but in order that the world might be saved through him. This is the message of the gospel. The proclamation of Christ is the one full, sufficient sacrifice, oblation, satisfaction for the sins of the world. Any other place we look for God, we will be tempted to say either my need for him is not that great or my God is not that good. But at the cross, we see what ends a holy and righteous God had to go through to reconcile himself to his people. And it's upon these ends that we rest by faith, not in ourselves, not in our ability to understand, not even in our sense of need, but in the fact that there stands the promise that he has come for us, that he is the righteous branch raised up for our redemption, and that he will never leave us nor forsake us, even to the ends of the earth. Thanks be to God.